oftentimes in sci-fi films, and you and I've talked about this before, just when you think a character's dead, oh no, he's back. We've found a way to, to morph him or to whatever him, and they never go away forever because you have another film to make in the franchise. And sad to say, they're doing that now with Ian Holm. Who knows who will do it with next, with actors, whether living or dead, where they can just take images from earlier films and now they're back again. I think that's kind of a scary thought in ways beyond the intended scariness.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Alien Romulus and Blink Twice, starting with the new Alien movie. Mike, there's a recent acquisition of 20th Century Fox with all of their IP, and I think they just couldn't resist the urge to dig in there and get another Alien movie out of it. So overall, what was your sense of the movie, whether you liked it, didn't like it, how many more Alien movies are there, etc.?
Well, this is number seven in the franchise, and to give some background and some context on it, way back in 1979, I went up to New York for the film's premiere. We were the very first audience to see it, and so we had no idea that the chest burst sequence was going to be there. And it was at the Ziegfeld Theater, which was a fabulous theater in New York City, and just the screams and the laughter, and it's just like an all-time great memory of just how shocked an audience can be by something. And specifically, the reason I was there as a film critic was I was then the next morning doing interviews with the director Ridley Scott, and with the stars Sigourney Weaver and Tom Skerritt, and with the artist H.R. Giger. And I think it's H.R. Giger's film as much as anybody's. It's just fabulous artwork and production design. And the film did extremely well back then, both critically and commercially. And it wasn't just like a hit movie, it was a phenomenon in a lot of ways. And a lot of people, myself included, would have considered it, an instant classic. And 20th Century Fox, the releasing studio, did a really great job with the marketing. I mean, critics can be cynical about PR, but they really handled it masterfully. And 20th Century Fox, which now has dropped the Fox, just 20th Century, kept putting out more movies. Now, as you know, I'm not a big fan of franchises and sequels and sequelitis and all that. But I gotta say, like with Alien, I was not exactly looking for any sequels. But when James Cameron did Aliens, I thought, that's a really good film. I think it holds up. I think what's happened, though, is over time, a franchise perhaps only has so much energy or so many ideas, and it just hits the instant replay button there. I very much felt that way with this latest Alien Romulus. I just thought, in many ways, the real weakness of it is in the script. The characters are paper thin. You really don't learn much about them. And so, in that sense, I don't want to see anyone eat. Well, usually I don't want to see anyone eaten by monsters, but I just had very little investment in them as characters. And that was really kind of flat. And the dialogue in particular was really predictable and really so mediocre that, it was not at all clever. And yes, there are some jump scares that work. And yes, there's some artwork derived from the original H.R. Giger things. And the alien or aliens, they're as scary as ever. But by now they're like old friends, I suppose. But they're still scary. Yeah, some friends that were scary. They're as scary as ever. So I really felt like this latest one was just sort of marking time. Now, in terms of time, and again, by way of background and context, the story that we get here involves people on a mining colony on a planet, and it's really like the worst kind of near slave labor conditions, and they want to escape, they want to get away. And then they think they'll get up to this spaceship and that'll be their salvation. Well, lo and behold, guess who else is on board? And so there's that. Now, within that chronology, the story as we get it here occurs just after the original Alien, and therefore like before Alien. So it's sort of plugging in a hole, if you will. Not that I felt the need to have that plugged, but the fact that it does sort of fit in that way. But let me turn it back over to you, Marie, because I feel that it's just overly familiar material at this point. And as I'm watching it, I'm just kind of marking time. The characters I barely know or care about, yeah, they're going through a ship that has really neat production design, but it's like, it's sort of an Agatha Christie story at a certain point. This one gets knocked off, that one gets knocked off, and I'm just sort of keeping score. So how did you keep score?
Well, you've made a lot of my points for me. But starting off with the chest burster scene from the original movie, I will never forget that scene because it took me by such surprise. And I had a clutch purse in my hand that I waved in the air, screaming. And then I'm like, look, wait, what am I doing? Just really, I will never forget how original that was. But, given that that was original and everybody remembers it, they keep trying to return to that same sort of moment. I think it's a well-paced sci-fi thriller with great production design, and it's an intriguing mystery. The acting is pretty good, but it's sort of bolted to this predictable horror tropes, stupid people doing stupid things, protracted chase scenes, recycled dialogue. It's half of a good movie, and it had a lot of potential. I mean, a lot of the things really seemed pretty interesting. And then it kind of devolves into mindless action and body horror, which is disappointing. But I did think that the android in this movie was one of the strongest android characters. There's one in every Alien movie. I thought the actor in this one, David Johnson, he played two different roles, really, really quite good.
Well, that's a good point, actually. As the android named Andy, he actually, ironically, has more personality than many of the humans. And I did like him, and I liked the performance as well there. And that was actually entertaining because, again, it has that pro forma kind of formulaic quality of, human needs and android sidekick thing. But it actually worked here and almost brought the film to life, if you will. So those scenes actually sometimes did have some genuine heart content. You really felt like there was a presence, whether electronic or human, there was a presence there. And I think if anything, Marie, the film would have benefited more from developing that a bit further, as this essentially machine proves very humane in a lot of ways, and less of the running down corridors. Because a lot of that is the predictable, as you say, jump scare material. And again, stupid characters oftentimes get what they deserve, right? So you always want to, like in horror movies, you want to say, don't go in that room, right? Or don't go in
In
that
they
chamber.
go.
But they go anyway. So, okay, they're going to get it. And they get it. And the film has a lot of gross out moments, and they should be really shocking. But by now, too, we've all been there before. In other words, much as these monsters are disgusting, it's a familiar disgusting quality. And so even there, it's sort of like, not that I yawn at it, but I'm not I didn't have a purse to toss in the air. But I mean, there was. But there's no longer quite that, and happy you could never really get that shock element back. By now, what the see one of the great things about the first film was that 20th Century Fox did such a great job at the marketing that they told. Now, as press, we should have had the inside word. We went to New York knowing very little about that film. They really kept it under wraps. And so we had no idea what the monsters would look like, much less when they would appear. And in any event, even if you go back and watch it now, the film is so well paced, the Ridley Scott original is so well paced that you're well into it, really. I mean, there's a sense, an ominous sense, there's a menacing quality to it, but it's a while before you actually get the delivery that way. Well, now in this one, the moment these people escape from the mining colony planet and head up to the ship, we all know what's going to be there. We all know what's in the offing. And I think that's something, once you lose that, and particularly now that we're at number seven in the series, audiences just, again, there's like checking boxes. Okay, this, okay, that.
You made a point about the paper-thin characters, and I think that's one of the drawbacks, even though I think the acting is pretty decent. All the characters have a similar background, and they're all 20-somethings. I found it hard to remember anybody in it afterwards besides the android character and Kaylee Spaney, who, by the way, I have liked in a lot of things. She was in Civil War and Priscilla, and on the basis of sex, she played Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, she's a really good actor who you kind of see in things. And, every time you see her, like, oh, yeah, I think I've seen her in something and I like her. I thought she was really good in this. But I don't think they give them enough difference so that you really feel like you've got a crew of different characters.
Well, see, that's a problem here because I admire her as an actor because she has such a diverse body of work. And as I'm watching this, it was somewhat distracting. I thought, well, what is Priscilla Presley doing on this spaceship? But no, I mean, as the actor, she really immerses herself in very different roles, and she's really convincing them. The problem here is she doesn't have much to work with. When you're all gussied up in your spacesuit and you're running down a corridor and the monster's behind you, there are only so many facial expressions or screams you can have, right? And so I don't think any actor, I mean, I don't think Vanessa Redgrave even, well, she'd probably kill the monster, but I mean, I don't think like even a really great actor could do much with that role. And so not that she's wasted here exactly, but she doesn't exactly transcend the material. Let's put it that way. And I don't blame her whatsoever here. I mean, how much could you do with this? And as paycheck jobs go, it's a good one. I mean, it's a good thing on the resume to have this, but I would like her to see more of the serious films you and I just mentioned. that she's been in. I'd like to see her work more in that area, because any number of actresses in their 20s, let's be blunt about it, if you're presentable, if you photograph well and you're in your 20s, you too can run from the aliens, right? So I think any number of actresses of her generation could have done that role, and it would be just the same. So not that she wasted an opportunity here, but you just don't want her to go, no, let's put it this way, you don't want her to go on and make more alien movies. Let her make more Elvis Presley movies or something.
Something. Yeah, I agree with you. The other thing I found kind of hard to suspend disbelief is that there's this abandoned spaceship that is orbiting their planet with, supplies on it that they want to go get. But nobody else, including the company that abandoned their research, is interested in this thing. I would think it would already been stripped, or at least they would have other people looking to cabbage things from the spaceship. I found that really unbelievable.
It bothered me actually. I had about 101 logical reservations, and that was high on the list because, first of all, we don't know much about this mining colony on the planet. That's one of the problems. We don't have much background there. I mean, we sort of get the dystopian picture, but we don't, it's not really fleshed out in a meaningful way. And it doesn't matter very quickly because they're fast to make their escape, right? But the thing that bothered me that also bothered you was that this ship has been orbiting. And this, we're not talking about some little helicopter or something. This is like a really big ship, right? And when they get on it, it's like everything's still there. You just have to flip the switch. And I thought, isn't that great? Just turn on the switch and you got all the juice and everything else. And I thought, why wouldn't other people on the planet, particularly the bureaucratic types, have presumably known, not only known about it, but commandeered it, right? Taken it over, done something. But it's almost as if they just, like, they've got the secret. They found out. They're up there doing. And I thought, that's really so improper. In science fiction, you have to provide a lot of latitude, I realize. But even within the parameters of that, I thought, this just doesn't make sense that this thing. And it seemed like it was a very quick flight, didn't it? It seemed like, pretty quickly they got to it. And I thought, something doesn't parse here. And that's again where the script is so flimsy that it's just a pretext to get them on the ship. And then from then on, it's just the jump scares and running down long corridors.
Now, we should address the fact that we do get a character from another alien movie back by way of AI. And what did you think about that? I mean, it looked
As
cool,
a
but ethically, what do you think about that?
ethically, I have so many reservations about that. And yet what I did, I mean, I always read the end credits, and what I found interesting, so we're talking about Ian Holm, who of course was in the first one, and his character gets dealt with there. The actor himself, Ian Holm, died in 2020. So what we're talking about is the fact that he's been gone for a few years, and yet through AI they sort of resurrected him, and he's now playing a character named, if it's a character named Ash, who's an android. It was sort of neat just to see it, at least for a few minutes, like, whoa, look what they can do with AI now. But as with so much that's AI related, it's like, well, there's the good side and the bad side, if you will. But ethically, it troubled me to resurrect someone that way. I mean, imagine, you could have a resurrected dead politician running for office. Maybe we do already. How would you vote for this thing? Yes, I love Abraham Lincoln, but didn't he die in 1865? No, he's running for office again. But what I found interesting in the end credits was, well down in the credits, near the very end of the end credits, they thank the estate of Ian Holm. And I don't know much beyond what I just said, but I wonder what the financial terms were. This is also one of the ethical or legal ethical considerations here. If you're going to use somebody's image who's no longer around, but the family still controls the estate, gee, what's that paycheck like? And what degree of control would they have over how you use them? I mean, he's actually well deployed here in terms of what the character's meant to do on its own terms. But what if you somehow were part of that family estate and you're overseeing and sanctioning? What kind of guardrails or limits would you have? Because after all, a less honorable filmmaking team could do any number of things with the character. And I should explore further here, but I'm really curious as to exactly how that works in a legal sense. And back to your source question, ethically, I'm not a big fan of doing things like this because I think ultimately it's just distracting. In other words, as I'm watching it, I'm thinking about everything I've just vocalized, and I'm not thinking about the story itself. It's taken me out of the story that way because I'm thinking, gee, didn't Ian Holm die a few years ago? But now he's back. And ultimately, where I turn against it as a practice here on a very pragmatic level is just that oftentimes in sci-fi films, and you and I've talked about this before, just when you think a character's dead, oh no, he's back. We found a way to, to morph him or to whatever him, and they never go away forever because you have another film to make in the franchise. And sad to say, they're doing that now with Ian Holm. Who knows who will do it with next, with actors, whether living or dead, where they can just take images from earlier films and now they're back again. I think that's kind of a scary thought in ways beyond the intended scariness.
Now, Carrie Fisher, who they've done the same thing with in some of the Star Wars movies, said when she was still alive that her image was pretty much owned by George Lucas. So she felt like every time she looked in a mirror, she should like cut him a check. But what do you think, Mike? I think there could be one more alien movie where all of the people are gone and it's just androids, because it would be a different sort of standoff.
Well, the characters would have more depth for starters. But that, that's the thing. Like, there's so many of these aliens, so many of these critters running around that it actually would be interesting to have a film in which, whether it's on a spaceship or a planet, that's the civilization, that's the community. And there might just be one or two people who somehow stumble into it, get projected. I mean, goodness knows, I don't want to see this film. I don't want it being made. But if they were to do it, it would be a logical way to handle it. Just that the aliens are such tough critters that they've not only taken over a ship, but they've taken over, a universe, if you will, something like that. I mean, take it to those, to that sort of logical extreme of they're so dominant at this point. Whereas leave us. Now, some of the earlier alien films, obviously, played with notions like that, it's humanity against the aliens, who's going to win? And so, what do you think? I mean, I think you could actually sort of push in that direction, but you have to be happy to do away with the people entirely and just have androids and aliens. There's the title right there.
Androids and aliens, when they make it, you heard it here first. So let's move on to Blink Twice, which I have to say I was really impressed with. This is Zoe Kravitz's first directing gig. And if you didn't know already, she's Lenny Kravitz is her dad, and Lisa Bonet is her mom, which is important actually, because some of those things come into the movies. Like very early on in the movie, when the main character, played by Naomi Ackie, is looking at her phone, there's a quick glimpse of a viral video of Lenny Kravitz doing a workout in the gym. So there's like these little clues. Mike, I'm trying to figure out how do we talk about this movie without giving anything away.
Well, while we have an inside baseball discussion about how Zoe Kravitz and the family, if you will, of course, and the co-star of the film, Channing Tatum, is her significant other, her partner. So it's a home movie in some ways. It's a family movie. You're right. We've got to be careful not to have spoilers here. But I'm happy to say that I wasn't as happy with the film as you were. The film deals ostensibly with issues of race and class, namely that two young women who are working at a hoity-toity museum gala ingratiate themselves with a tech mogul, and that's the character played by Channing Tatum. And and I'm not the first one to describe him this way. He's a Jeffrey Epstein type character. He's a billionaire, playboy. He owns his own island. He's predatory when it comes to young women, and so that's like a really valid point of departure. And I like the film in the early scenes. I like the premise for it, and I like the fact that it's really well shot, the cinematography. And well, yeah, it's really the cinematographer, deserves credit here, and as does the production design team, because it's really a smart looking film initially. Well, the museum gala material is sort of standard issue decadence, but once it gets to the island, the resort itself really just is visualized well. I mean, it's just really striking tropical colors and really good framing. Where the film started to lose me was actually as it gets to the island. Again, they're dealing with all the hot button issues here in terms of race and class, gender, you name it. It's on the agenda, but it's underwritten, extensively underwritten. And to give a case in point, our principal character, Frida, the Naomi Ackie character. The fact that she's black in some movies wouldn't be, a conversation point. It's like, okay, so a character's black or white, it's just somehow it wouldn't factor directly, let's say, into the dynamics of a story. It's just you got to be some color, right? So she's one color and not another. But what's significant here is the fact that she's a young black woman and a young white woman. A young white woman is her friend, and then a young, relatively young or middle-aged white man, the Channing Tatum billionaire character, is the one who takes a keen interest in her. And like he has a stable, I'll call it a stable because it's a good insulting term. He has a stable of young women, and why they're all on the island together and how he keeps them there and all that, you can't say too much without spoiling it. But he's like the master of the universe there. And it's not just him. The stable also includes a lot of his guy pals, and these really are like really macho, I would say even like misogynist characters. I mean, the way they treat women and all, and played by some really well-known actors, including Christian Slater and Kyle MacLachlan. So anyway, it's the guys who are mistreating the women, let's put it that way. But in terms of how the guys consider the women and why they're so intrigued, particularly by her character, there's a racial dynamic that it's like visually there, but thematically simply not dealt with. The fact that she, as an aspiring young Black woman looking to get ahead in the world, latches on to the Slater King, that's the Channing Tatum character. He invites her to this gorgeous island, and she realizes maybe everything's not the way it seems here, and then can't say too much more without spoiling it, but the fact that his interest in her, you know, again, by way of racial dynamics and the history, really, of, you know, in terms of Blacks and whites in America, there's something that's either going on there or should be going on there. This is simply never discussed. It's never mentioned within the film. And as I said a moment ago, in some films, you'd say, so what? It's not relevant. You got to be some color. But you know what? In this film, it should matter because so many issues in terms of race, class, gender are hit. And what happens here, I think, is when it hits those buttons, it hits them very quickly. And then becomes sort of a standard issue horror film, essentially. And that the film really totally intrigued me for the early scenes and totally lost me by about the midpoint. Without spoiling anything, the story takes some really extreme and I would say borderline absurd turns further into the story. And I just found myself rolling the eyes like, oh, brother, here we go. And at that point, it's all, and the expression I love overusing is it goes off the rails. I think by the final scenes, it's just craziness of some sort. And I think it's a squandered opportunity. I think the film had so much potential, and I just don't think it realizes it.
Well, it reminded me of Midsommar in that sort of creepy tone where you're someplace that's supposed to be beautiful, but at the same time, you just have this overarching dread that kind of permeates everything. I did appreciate the female point of view. I thought because it was a female director that she shot things differently than I think a man would have shot the film. I keep thinking of that scene. They kept repeating it because I guess they kept doing this. They have all these women wearing the same white dress, which looks good on none of them. It has this giant bow in the back that reminds me of every bridesmaid's dress I wore in the 80s. I think that probably connected visually with women in a way that men who've never worn anything like that wouldn't have picked up on. I thought there were moments like that that were really like on the money. Having one of the characters be a survivor star from like a reality series. I used to like watching those shows. So I thought that was funny. And I thought that was an interesting twist, but she didn't really use any survival skills. So it's sort of wasted. I see what you mean about wasted opportunity. Yes, it's an island. It's supposed to be paradise. It's got snakes on it, you know, kind of gives you that sort of elemental first problem ever kind of thing. In terms of stars, I was shocked to see Geena Davis in just sort of a throwaway role. It was really kind of cool to see all the people who were involved in it. But the other thing that I thought in terms of the island, and you mentioned Epstein, there was also a, you couldn't help but think about Bill Cosby. And given that Zoe Kravitz is Lisa Bonet's daughter, I thought that was pretty daring. And then finally, I thought the ending was a banger. I thought the ending saved it from all the things I just criticized.
Well, in terms of squandered opportunities in the casting, it was funny initially, the female character who was on Survivor, one of the survival series. I mean, she actually is very funny as she talks about that, but then a squandered opportunity is, you're absolutely right, it's not turned to full advantage. She should be the one who's, you know, all out in fighting mode or something, but it doesn't play out quite that way for her character. So it's sort of like weird, like, well, why would you set her up this way as this tough survivor, quite literally, and then not fully exploit that? Another squandered opportunity would be with the Slater King character, the billionaire, the mogul who owns the island. And to Channing Tatum's credit, he plays him in a way that makes him really despicable. He doesn't play him in a way where you think, gee, what a handsome, strong actor, blah, blah, blah. No, he really plays him in a way like a kind of When I say derelict, I mean morally derelict, but also just somebody who just does whatever he wants to do. So if he doesn't shave one day, so what? If he looks a little sloppy, so what? He's the Lord of the universe, will do what he wants. And I thought Channing Tatum actually was convincing there, but where it's a squandered opportunity is with that character, because this is a guy who, as a businessman, apparently has done some sinning in a financial sense, and he's going to apologize, blah, blah, blah. But it's never really dealt with in a meaningful way. It's just like a quick, again, sort of offhand reference there. Yet another squandered opportunity would be in the relationship between that character, that billionaire, and his sister. That's the Geena Davis character you referred to. Yeah, it is neat to see her that way, but it's just sort of like, whoa, look who's here. It's like famous actors we've seen before. But when you think about it as a sibling relationship, she sort of pops in and out of the film, and it never fully scores or registers what that relationship is like between brother and sister. Well, yeah, we get the basic idea. But that's where you could have done so much more with that. Because after all, she is the sister of this monstrous mogul, and yet she is a woman. So, you know, push come to shove, do you side with your brother, or do you side with the women who are being mistreated on this island? It doesn't really give her much to work with, Geena Davis, as an actor. And so what those scenes, when they're compelling, are compelling because of the really good cinematography and production design. They're smart looking scenes, but I don't think the script is as smart as it assumes it is, or would like to be.
Speaking of smart, I like Channing Tatum and I liked him in this, but I think it would have been better if it had been Chris Pine, like the character he played in Don't Worry, Darling, where it comes across very suave, very smooth, but you always sense that sort of sinister. He seems capable of what he has done. Channing Tatum doesn't, he doesn't strike me as a tech mogul or somebody who would be able to mastermind this kind of thing.
Well, you know, I think that's the problem again in the script. I think physically he looks appropriate for the role, and that kind of decadent appearance that he's willing to give himself. He's not glammed up. I mean, he's got all the money in the world, but if he wants to be a slob and have another drink, he'll do that, right? And so, you know, I admired the performance at that level. And so many of his roles over the years have been basically playing decent characters, good guys, right? Maybe a little seedy circumstances, but basically good guys. He doesn't attempt to be sympathetic here. That's what I'm getting at. He's willing to make Slater King really unsympathetic, but we don't really know enough about the character. And so there are times in the film where he seems to be sleepwalking. I mean, as character and as actor. And that's actually, without spoiling anything, there are some altering substances here, whether you're talking about drink or drugs, whatever, that are going to affect your behavior. And so some of the sleepwalking behavior, or forgetfulness, if you will, in characters is very much built into the flimsy script. Some of it, I think, is just inadvertent, like, you know, actors sort of walking through scenes because they don't have very good dialogue or very good backgrounds as characters to work with. And that's where you simply walk across the shot, you know, and you're not quite there. Well, to some extent, maybe that's intended, not quite there. To some extent, it's just, well, what am I supposed to do now? You know, I'll just walk across the room. And so I think, Maria, I think that's partly what you're getting at with Channing Tatum. So Chris Pine actually would have been an interesting choice, but I think he would have faced the same dilemma. What do you do when you're meant just to like stare off into space? Well, you just stare off into space.
Yeah, well, I guess what you do is you hire somebody really attractive like Channing Tatum or Chris Pine just so we have something to look
Yeah, you could do worse. I mean, I'm not
at.
complaining about a despicable character, but you know, easy on the eyes, sure.
Easy on the eyes. Yes. So I do think, even though you didn't seem to think this was a really good movie, I did think it was a pretty good movie, and I am looking forward to seeing what this director does next because I think this is at least a promising debut. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, you know, for a debut feature, technically, it's well shot, and I'm giving credit to the cinematographer, but you know, she's the director, and she has a sense of atmosphere, of setting, of pacing. It actually, I think, pulls you in. It really has an almost hypnotic effect at times, and you know, a lot of credit to her. She's also the co-writer, co-screenwriter, and so mixed assessment there in terms of writing skills. But for a debut film, it is promising, and this is a case where yes, I absolutely would want to see her make another movie, so long as it's not an Alien sequel. You know, I'm all for it.
Well, that does bring us to the end of this show, but don't forget to check out our other podcasts at atnhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.